This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers.
Hey, everybody, it's Jessica. And this week we wanted to bring you the latest on the Trump administration. And we all know and can agree that there's a lot of news coming out of the White House. So who better to talk to than Joey Garrison? He is the White House correspondent for USA Today. He covers President Donald Trump. He previously reported on the 2020 presidential campaign after working as a national correspondent for USA Today based in Boston. From 2012 to 2019, Joey covered City Hall and politics for the Tennessean in Nashville, Tennessee, after working for the Nashville City Paper from 2009 to 2012. So I hope you enjoy this conversation. We covered a lot of ground here, again, about the latest news out of the White House.
Joey, thank you for joining us. And I would love to dive right in and talk about, what are the main things that you are working on today? I know today is the joint address to members of Congress. Obviously, that's going to happen in the future, so we won't talk about it. I think it feels like people are drinking water from a fire hydrant. I know you're looking at DOGE, at general funding cuts, at tariffs. What is the top of your list right now?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I mean, yeah, as you mentioned, it is a little bit like drinking from a fire hose the first 7 weeks of Trump's administration. Not surprisingly, it's been like that. They've talked about coming in, you know, with a shock and awe approach. And, you know, I don't think they've disappointed on that promise. A lot of that stuff is aimed at the MAGA base. And, you know, through a flurry of executive orders, you know, Trump has, you know, whether it's border enforcement or renaming Gulf of Mexico, Gulf America. He's delivered those things to that base. Now, what I'm focusing on a lot, as you mentioned, you know, is this DOGE effort, of course, overseen by Elon Musk. You know, rewinding a couple months ago when Trump announced DOGE shortly after his election win, I don't think we realized maybe then how much of an enormous role Musk would be playing in this Trump administration. You know, DOGE has you know, anywhere from 50 to 100 people there. It's hard to get a full grasp of the numbers of people working for DOGE because they're not completely transparent about it. But you know, they're working directly on the White House campus and have been fanning across the federal government, you know, taking control of IT infrastructure and implementing these aggressive cuts. And so part of that has included the workforce. And you know, we've looked at there's kind of been, I kind of think of the attack on the workforce in three phases. First, there was the fork in the road buyout offer that was offered to all federal workers. You know, in exchange for their resignation, they'd get 8 months of pay. There was about 77,000 federal workers who agreed to that. The next phase was this targeting of probationary workers. These are recently hired or promoted federal workers, and they were kind of indiscriminately fired based on that role because they have fewer civil service protections with that probationary status. So they were kind of easy targets. And now the next phase, looking ahead now, Trump administration has asked federal departments to prepare for large-scale reductions in force. And I think that might be a greater, you know, larger layoffs than we've had with just the probationary workers in the coming weeks here. Trump, during his cabinet meeting last week, mentioned possibly 65%, you know, cutting the EPA workforce by 65%. So I think this third phase that we're about to enter with the cuts, you know, could be the greatest.
Could you help us with scale for a minute? And you already did give us some context here, but what percentage of the federal workforce are we talking about in terms of who has been fired and or who's in the crosshairs? I know it probably a percentage is too precise, but what's the range here and how much could this affect the employment numbers the next time those come out? Because I know obviously that's something people look at to try and determine how the economy is doing.
So there's about 2.3 million federal workers. So that first 75,000, that was roughly about 3% or so of the federal workforce. So that was below, I think, the projections the White House had put out there, possibly 5 to 10%. Now, this probationary workers layoffs, we don't have a precise number on that. The administration has not said, hey, you know, this is how much government wide. You kind of have to get these from department to, from department. But I think it's fair to say, you know, there's been tens of thousands of that of layoffs from these probationary workers. So, you know, you're getting that number well above 100,000 now of people. And in addition to that, I will say I've kind of put kind of a broad brush stroke of all this. But within each individual department, like the education department has individual offers that they've given their employees, kind of a $25,000 buyout for them to leave. The Social Security Administration similarly has targeted buyouts in efforts to severance packages to get employees to resign. But, you know, you start getting to a certain point, and in certain communities, you're talking about a large economic impact. Obviously, D.C. is one of those, in neighboring Maryland. But it's not just the Beltway. There's other states where, you know, states like Utah, for example, where that have a large number of federal workers. And yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I'm not sure when economists expect this to initially appear, you know, on the start taking a toll on the unemployment monthly rate. Maybe it'll be in this next one, but it's definitely something that other, you know, certain communities are having to deal with.
Now, in terms of, just to skip around for a moment, talking about the economy, obviously, this was a huge issue in the election. It is always very rationally a huge issue in every election because it affects people's daily lives. We're recording this episode the morning of March 4th, and I know you've written about this and followed it. The tariffs are obviously something that will affect the economy. I'm being very broad here because we're talking about different levels of tariffs for different countries. Could you remind us, based on your reporting, where are we right now? Does it look like some tariffs will be going into effect, have gone into effect? And what are we looking at in terms of the short-term horizon here?
Yeah, so the tariffs on neighboring Mexico and Canada, 25% tariffs, went into effect on Tuesday. And quickly, you saw Canada, led by Justin Trudeau, respond with tariffs of their own. So we're certainly in a trade war with allies here. And in addition to those two sets of tariffs, you have President Trump doubling the recently added tariff on Chinese imports. And, you know, I think it's interesting, in large part, you know, Trump was elected back into the presidency based on this promise to lower prices, or at least the idea that he'd offer something different. President Biden, just for years, his final 2 or 3 years, was just really hammered on this issue and just seen as not the person that could turn around quickly enough to please Americans, the prices that were higher today than they were before the pandemic. And Trump promised on day one that he would be able to start lowering these prices, but that's not been the case. And you have this issue of the tariffs, which are, you know, are essentially taxes, duties on imports that really all economists say are going to lead to higher prices in certain goods. And so, you know, I think that's a real political consideration for the president. You don't see Republicans in Congress really embracing these, you know, really aggressive tariffs here, steep tariffs the president is doing. Now, he has argued that, look, there might be some short-term pain here, but the reason for this is it's going to lead to greater domestic investment in certain industries. We're going to increase manufacturing in these areas, and ultimately it'll be a good thing for the country. But that's a hard thing to sell once people are already fed up with, you know, 3-4 years of higher costs and the idea that they could accelerate further because of this. You're already starting to see the numbers that I think are troubling for the president. The consumer confidence reports in February have one of the steepest decline since August of 2021. There was a Reuters Ipsos poll that only gave President Trump a 39% approval rating on the economy. So, you know, I think this is an issue that's already tormented our last president. And I think it could start turning into that kind of issue for Trump. On Tuesday, you saw the stock market just plummet in response to these aggressive tariffs. Trudeau had, and other neighboring countries had, you know, real strong responses. And, you know, a trade war at this moment is a tough sell, I think, to a lot of Americans.
Well, and again, as you point out, Americans who voted in large numbers based on the economy and the perception, which, you know, we could have a longer discussion about, that it was Biden's fault, that the inflation issue right. was Biden's fault. Now, of course, any issue is more complicated than just being any one person's fault. And we know that inflation is caused by a number of different issues. But certainly anybody who presides over an economy where people at least perceive that they're struggling does so at their own peril. I actually want to pick up on part of your answer there, which was about Republicans in Congress not kind of fully embracing the tariffs. And I'm paraphrasing what you're saying, but I wanted to talk a little bit more generally about where you see, as somebody who's following the Trump White House, where you see members of Congress and particularly Republicans pushing back on the White House's agenda, or does it seem like it's actually quite copacetic right now and that there isn't much pushback?
Yeah, I mean, when I say they're not embracing the tariffs, I just mean it's not one of these issues that you see them really going to bat with the president.
Yeah, on. Yeah.
But, you know, there's also, it's as we know, Republicans in Congress, you know, at the same time, haven't really resisted much of Trump's agenda and him as the head of the Republican Party either. But I think it is just interesting to note. And, you know, there's other things as well that the role DOGE is playing. For example, you saw some of the town halls where Republicans, members of Congress were really hearing it from constituents in their districts over these widespread cuts to federal workers and the dismantling of some agencies like USAID and Consumer Protection Financial Bureau. Really hearing it from them. Now, some of those people at those town halls, I do think, were probably Democrats who made it inside there. But nevertheless, some of the things that Trump is doing present a political risk for other members of his party. You know, even though we are less, you know, nearly 2 years out from the midterm elections, that's something, you know, you see Democrats right now going on the attack more against the Elon Musk, who, by the way, pours very poorly right now, just as much as they are attacking Trump himself. And so, you know, I do think Republicans have kind of an interesting balancing act on how much they want to get behind some of these more controversial efforts that Trump is undertaking that stray further away from that, you know, lowering cost promise that he made through the campaign.
And I know what you're talking about, but just to make sure, can you outline the more "quote unquote" controversial efforts?
Well, I guess what I meant was just the DOGE efforts there, these tariffs.
Right.
I don't think you're going to see Republicans campaigning on the fact that they increased tariffs, for example, that helped likely produce higher prices. That doesn't seem like something that they're really rah-rah about at the moment. We'll see. And, you know, I know this will be recording later this week, but we'll see how Trump talks about his tariffs during his joint address to Congress and whether that's something he really wants to tout. And it'll be interesting to see what the response is from both aisles. You know, Democrats aren't going to stand up for it. I'm curious how many Republicans, you know, given this moment where we're seeing a real potential economic backlash as a result of it.
Well, so we've just talked about the Republican response and that they are, you know, in a place of supporting the president, but also being mindful of not supporting positions that hurt their constituents. And we talked a little bit about just now the Democratic response, but I'm hoping you can flesh that out. And I know that you cover a lot and that's not necessarily specifically your beat, but if you were to kind of characterize what the Democratic opposition is. Obviously, Democrats are the minority party. They don't have the Oval Office. They don't have Senate. They don't have Congress. But that, in my view, doesn't mean that you are utterly powerless. Is there a way that we could again try to explain whether or not there's been a organized Democratic response to what we see happening over the last month plus? Has it been a bit scattershot? Is it throwing pasta at a wall? Is it playing a long game? I think it might be difficult for people to try and ascertain what the strategy is here.
Yeah, I mean, I think there has been a organized response, and whether it's an effective one, remains to be seen. But I think they're trying to do a couple things. I think they're, and these aren't exactly surprising responses, but they're trying to paint Trump and Republicans as the party that is looking out for the elite and the wealthy here. And that's going to be, letting Elon Musk have the driver's seat in the White House and doing, cuts that they argue hurt working people. And this next year and the coming weeks, there's going to be a real fight over the Republican tax policy on renewing Trump's 2017 tax cuts and really going potentially even further with them in terms of tax cuts for corporations and the wealthiest Americans. So they're laying out that argument right now to try to defeat that. At the joint address for Congress, featured prominently by Democrats, are going to be some of the terminated federal workers in specific departments, saying, hey, there's a real cost to you as a result of these actions from DOGE. And, that is something that they're going to put out there and feature. You've seen, a lot of Democrats focus on the cuts to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, saying, look, they are, trying to make things easier for Wall Street and for banks and trying to hurt the average American by getting rid of this agency that is working directly for Americans who get screwed by financial institutions. So I think, that kind of class argument is at the center of what they're doing, but it's a difficult thing to do because the Democrats don't have, legislative control right now. They don't have power in the House or the Senate or the White House. So the biggest thing they're trying to do is create a public backlash here by pointing out some of these things. Hopefully they can, have election gains in this next midterms as a result of some of these things. And again, like I said earlier, I think they've really kind of made Musk into the new boogeyman for folks to be afraid of and trying to capitalize on what, again, he doesn't seem to be he's more of a polarizing figure in the Trump administration than the president himself. There's a poll from NPR Marist on Monday that said he has disapproval rating of 50% of Americans, only thought favorably of 39%. So you can see why you hear a lot of talk about Elon Musk from Democrats.
So if we could think about the Democratic response, does it seem to be a little bit more micro in the sense of this policy is a problem, that policy is a problem? I don't feel like I hear as much, and this could just be a function of what I'm hearing and when, about what we heard about during the election, the idea that Trump was going to pose an existential threat. Has that been abandoned, or is it just part of an overall strategy of trying to explain what Democrats view as the problems with the current administration?
I mean, I think it's somewhat of a harder argument to make now that he's in the White House. I mean, he is the president. It's harder to make that fear factor in there when he actually is, in the White House. And I think, that message, the thing that was always problematic about that message is it didn't speak to, it is a very popular one message among some on the liberal base, thinking about how he's a threat to democracy, et cetera. But for others, again, that didn't necessarily respond to their, concerns about the economy and some of their, everyday concerns of just getting by and improving their lives. And so, you have heard, less of that, I think. But, at the same time, as Trump has aligned himself further with Putin, for example, during this, in terms of, whether U.S. is going to support Ukraine and questions about that, you've heard backlash from Democrats, saying, hey, he's, aligning not with a democratic country in Ukraine, but instead with a dictator here. So you still hear elements of that, but that's not the chief response. I think that Democrats are going to you know, believe is effective. But to your point, you know, it has been, I think, difficult for Democrats to get their message out. I think, you know, when it comes to social media, I think maybe they have a problem. Republicans are often, you know, whether it's on X or other outlets, I think some of these, you know, the social media of that the Republicans and Musk and Trump are pushing out there might be getting seen more than that of Democrats. So it is something where they have a response, but maybe it's not one that's getting, you know, heard as much.
Well, and you've actually, Joey, brought us to the next big substantive area that I want to talk about, which is foreign policy. And you were mentioning Russia and Putin. And I know you've written about this now, I think, famous meeting between President Trump and Zelensky in the Oval Office. And I want to continue to be extremely general in my questions, which is under the understanding that it's very difficult for people to keep up on everything at any given time. There was a meeting between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine last week. It kind of dissolved. Zelensky, I understand, was potentially asked to leave the White House. There was no deal on minerals that was signed. Could you give us the broad brush of what was Zelensky doing in the Oval Office? What was the purpose of the meeting? What did people expect to happen? And what actually did happen?
Yeah, so the meeting, as you mentioned, was to hash out and eventually sign this minerals agreement whereby the U.S. would essentially capitalize on some of the, you know, revenue of minerals that are in the ground and in Ukraine in exchange for essentially continued U.S. support of Ukraine. But, you know, about 35 or 40 minutes into that meeting in the Oval Office, which, by the way, there was still press in there. Usually these kind of bilateral meetings, you know, under Biden, for example, the press would come in there for the what's called like the pool spray at the beginning and get a couple of photos, maybe a couple comments. Then they'd be escorted out after 3 minutes or so. It was extraordinary to have this meeting going on for 50 minutes, all with press in there. And again, about 40 minutes in, the blow up essentially started with Vice President J.D. Vance, who was also in there, you know, saying, hey, you know, it's time for diplomacy because, you know, Joe Biden for 4 years talked big and tough against Putin, but didn't stop Russia from invading Ukraine. It's time to, you know, really use diplomatic ways to end this. Well, Zelensky, you know, pointed out that Putin hadn't listened to previous ceasefires agreements that he had adhered to and disobeyed them. And so, and he asked the question back to Vance, and he said, and he called him JD. I mean, he said, you know, what kind of diplomacy are you talking about here? And that just created sort of a public spat there, real shouting match between the three of them, with President Trump eventually accusing Zelensky of, you know, not wanting peace and wanting to start World War III. And, you know, again, I think Zelensky comes from it from this attitude of look, you know, we're the country that was invaded here. You know, we're simply trying to maintain our sovereignty, our democratic government here. You know, and Russia is the instigator here, but the disconnect is coming from the fact that the Trump administration doesn't seem to be putting any weight on that fact and essentially looking at them as equals here in this conflict. Mm. And it's really, and so, you know, whereas Biden, you know, for years, you know, condemned, you know, Putin's invasion that's now, well, 3 years ago. You know, Trump hasn't really, you know, said as much and has even, you know, at one point even accused Zelensky of starting this war. So, you know, I think there's a, when Trump says, hey, it's time for peace here, Zelensky is thinking to himself, well, what does he mean by peace? I don't want to give up land that is our land. I don't want to give up other concessions here. I want to beat who they see as their enemy. So anyways, on Friday, that was sort of the underlying thing happening here. I mean, again, Trump is essentially upending you know, decades of policy in terms of what we've had regarding Putin and Russia. And this is a difficult situation for Zelensky to see how he proceeds in his war. Now, or in defending itself in the war started by Russia. Now, on Monday, as we reported on other outlets, the Trump administration confirmed that they are planning to at least temporarily withhold U.S. aid to Ukraine until what they say is until Zelensky is ready to actually talk about a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. And then you saw a statement put out by Zelensky on Tuesday, really kind of for the first time saying that he, you know, regrets how the meeting with Trump went down and said he's, you know, ready to start talking about a peace deal. I think it's for a couple of days now, you've heard the Trump's White House saying, hey, we need to hear an apology from Zelensky and we need to hear that, you know, that he's appreciative of U.S. support. And that's what you saw, I think, in that statement from Zelensky saying, hey, okay, let's forget about that. Let's try to move forward with where things are. It remains to be seen, you know, whether that's enough for Trump to, again, revisit talks with Ukraine.
That's really helpful in trying to sort out, you know, what happened and what could happen moving forward. And the last thing I want to ask you about is not foreign policy and not the economy, but the response to much of what President Trump has tried to achieve or is achieving in the courts, not in the court of public opinion, but in the courts. And in covering the White House specifically, I don't think we need to go through every case. There are many cases. There are multiple cases on multiple executive orders. And what I'm curious about is if you see a possibility or potentially the inclination on the part of the administration to at some point not follow a judicial order, because this is obviously the big question. Are we in a constitutional crisis? Are we going to be in a constitutional crisis? I know it's just guessing at this point. My definition of constitutional crisis, and I know it's different for other people and other professors, has been there's a valid court order, and particularly from the Supreme Court, and the Trump administration says, thank you so much, but no.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'll see, but the Trump and his closest allies have put out, including Elon Musk and others, have put out this idea of that, you know, that it's a president's decision on whether to, not a judge's decision on, you know, what is the law. So that does set up that, you know, crisis. I think that there's obviously a number of different lawsuits and, but I think a number of them touch on this one theme, and then it's going to be, I think, ultimately just settled by the Supreme Court. And that's deals with executive power and what the Trump folks, led by Russ Vogt, OMB director, have argued is this widespread power to decide how funding is used, to decide regulations that, you know, historically we've kind of deferred to Congress as the setters of those things. And I think that argument, you know, I can point to a number of cases that kind of deal with this underlying thing. But I think, you know, in some ways, maybe it's been a plan all along to try to get this, you know, decided up to the Supreme Court, where, of course, Republicans have a 6-3 conservative majority that likely gives them, you know, good hopes to try to get some of these things settled and for the court to decide that the president does, in fact, have the power to disregard, you know, various laws set by Congress. Of course, you're the law professor here, but I think, do you think I'm right on that? Do you see that trend there as well?
I do. I mean, I think that obviously statements have been put out for a reason. They weren't accidental statements, that the ultimate power to make decisions rests with the president. I would say our system, of course, is based on the idea that there are three co-equal branches. For hundreds of years, all the way back to Marbury versus Madison, we have been comfortable with the idea of judicial review. And we've been comfortable with the idea that Congress might enact legislation that the president signs. And if the Supreme Court looks at that legislation and says, I'm sorry, it's not consistent with the Constitution, then that's that. We have never stress tested what comes next, of course, which is a president saying, well, you don't have the army. You have no way of enforcing that decision because our government is a trust exercise in many ways. But yes, I think that is very helpful in helping us think through this question. And Joey, my last question to you is just, what is your daily life like right now? I mean, we've covered so many topics. You've been able to talk off the top of your head about all of them because I follow what you write and you're reporting on so many different things. Is this appreciably different than following a different administration? I'm not asking you, obviously, you know, do you like it or do you agree with them? But just in terms of the daily life of somebody who's, you know, working at your level of journalism at a national outlet following the administration, what is the day-to-day like for you?
Yeah, I'm probably ready for a vacation pretty soon because it's been pretty nonstop. But yeah, I mean, it's action-packed. It's, there's kind of been a cadence in a way with how Trump, operates. He's had on numerous days, it'll be either a new handful of executive orders or other, things that he will be doing in the Oval Office about 2 o'clock or so. And then for the next hour, he ends up making a ton of other news because he's talking to reporters. And so that part of it is so much different than President Biden, who, as we all know, was less visible often compared to Trump. And, they were more programmatic in terms of, hey, we're going to have an event today where Biden is talking about getting rid of junk fees or whatever. Trump, in contrast, it's more sporadic. For example, we knew that these tariffs were going to go into effect, but at the same time, did we really know they were, or could there be a last minute deal to avert them like there was a month ago? So, I think that's part of the challenge with covering Trump is you don't know which direction things might be going to that on that day. Now, as a reporter, though, I mean, I regardless of which president it is, you just love to be in that, in the center of the action where decisions that are, going to affect the entire country, the world, and how people are living, to be able to get that first draft and to be holding officials accountable and to be tracking all, that's what you love about doing it. And so, I think I can't say one way or another whether I enjoy covering one administration more than the other, but I will say this one that has been a lot out of the gate, a lot more action-packed than the last in various different ways, I would say.
Well, I know you're very busy. So, Joey, thank you for your time. I really appreciate this conversation. We covered so much ground and it was helpful for me, and I know it will be for the listeners. So thank you again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you again. Have me on anytime.